doing things like that. You got it, Mark.
Okay, I don't know if this is the same one or not. I'm going to go to my email and find it and send it to you. It's a car. It runs on fresh air. It has a range of 125 miles or something along those lines. And you can charge it up with a compressor, I guess at compressor station, wherever, in about 3 to 4 minutes. And it's a funny little thing, but if it works, you know, they show pictures of the engine and everything else. I will send it to you. And I'll let you guys continue. I'll be listening. Great net. And to SLS, thank you.
Okay. Rich, Mel, and Eric, in that order. Mark, these renewable energy type vehicles, dynamic braking type vehicles, a beautiful technique. We've got to do more of that. I had something I was going to say on this one. I forgot. Rich, N2EL, go right ahead.
Okay. Okay, wait for a beat. Okay, Dick, just a comment. I wonder if you remember in the mid-1950s, when nuclear power was first coming in online, President Eisenhower made statements that energy was going to be so cheap, you wouldn't be able to measure the cost.
Yeah, that was the belief at that time. We were going to get rid of the watt-hour meters on the side of each house. We're all going to pay a flat rate and a very low rate. And if you look at the pure amount of energy you get out of a pound of U-235, it sounds good. He completely forgot about the fact that that U-235 didn't just happen. A huge amount of subsidy is required to research where the stuff is located, refine it out of the ground, and it's in very low density in the ground. You have to do all kinds of refining to get it down to the uranium from all of the other ore that it's buried in. Then you have to refine the 235 out of the 238. Very difficult to do nuclear fission with 238. You have to find the 235, so therefore you got to use some kind of a fractional distillation process. And so the process of getting that nuclear fuel into your hand is very expensive. You look at the total fuel cycle, it is not cheap. That's the bad news. The good news is that once you make that investment, it does make you a hell of a lot more energy independent. And there are a number of foreign countries which have much higher percentage of their electrical power coming from a nuclear source, and it can be done successfully if you've got a real good design that is universal, not having a different design for every single power plant. We were sort of doing that for a while in the United States, and that's crazy. And with good designs, you don't have to have accidents, and even if you do have accidents, they can be a hell of a lot more controlled than some of the ones that have happened in the past. So for us to thoroughly reject nuclear power, saying not in my backyard, it's much too closed-minded. For us to say that we're going to protect the Alaskan wildlife and we're not going to allow drilling to take place there, that's a very expensive decision. To say that we're not going to drill any more offshore wells and we're not going to establish any more oil refineries, again, a very expensive decision. Very short-sighted, in my opinion. We have to look at a much bigger picture. The direction that we are going is that we're becoming more and more dependent on energy import. And that is making us more and more vulnerable to all kinds of wartime situations. And we don't want war. I mean, we can sit here and say, I'm not going to go to war anymore. Well, if you did that, all of a sudden you don't drive your automobile. And so that's short-sighted. We got to look at the bigger picture as I see it. Mel was the next person, K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KEY. All right. The air-driven vehicle, they're producing one in France. They're using it as a taxi cab. Now, the problem, of course, is that it takes a lot of pumping to get these tanks up filled with enough compressed air. So, you know, you've got to get the electric pump to work. And, of course, the electricity has to come from a place. And if it's being, the electric power plant is being run by regular conventional petroleum, well, you're basically almost back where you started from to some extent. The only thing that has happened is the number of places that they showed you that, you know, electric vehicles The amount of research that goes into producing or trying to produce a really economical and car that can be mass produced and really be, you know, viable, again, is another situation that is not really a crash program. So you've heard of this one, the Tesla, this car that's out being built, hand-built in California, called the Tesla. They're $100,000 a piece. And one of the stumbling blocks is they got to put the battery together cell by cell. They also like to use a bunch of AA cells and building a battery. So there you are. It's not a crash program because as long as the petroleum is available at any price, there's the bottom line. When it's not going to be available at any price, then you will see progress in alternate systems. But not till then. Over.
Yeah, mass production can do beautiful things. The very first television receive-only terminals, built in roughly 1973, were numbers like $20,000 for the dish, the low-noise amplifier, the down converter, and so on. Numbers like $20,000. By the time you get up to 1995, that same hardware with much higher efficiency, much lower noise figure, much smaller dish, much nicer receiver, to be bought for around $300. $20,000 can down to $300 and higher in performance, partially due to Southeast Asia mass production. When it comes to these exotic vehicles we're talking about, choose a good design and mass produce it, and with mass production the price can become a small fraction of what it was. But one other thing I want to mention here, and that is various presidents and other political people have thought that we should start discontinuing the use of petroleum products and start using hydrogen-powered vehicles. Sounds good. You don't have the infrastructure to distribute the hydrogen. You can't go to a gas station and get it. Where do you get it from? Probably by electrolysis of water. Where does the energy come from to break down water into hydrogen and oxygen? It comes from electrical power. Where does the electrical power come from? Burning coal and oil. They're back to the same process. And the hydrogen is a much lower energy density fuel, and the same size tank with hydrogen is going to give you 100 miles of mileage on the car instead of 400 miles you get out of a petroleum product. The nice thing about compressed air is that although it takes you a long time to run the compressor, let me drop, to give you a tank full of compressed air, once you've got the tank full of compressed air, at the gas station, you can vent that into your high-pressure tank in your vehicle into a very small number of minutes. Whereas you try to dump the energy electronically into a set of batteries while you're parked at that gas station, without changing the batteries themselves, is very difficult. The thing I like about the compressed air process is that you don't have to spend a long time being refueled if you go to the right kind of a gas station. So it's got certain advantages. Eric, K2EJ, what would you like to add to all this? K2RIW for TechNet.
Before that, please, Dick, what's your email?
I'm listed in ARRL, K2RIW at ARRL.net is probably the easiest one. As I said, you go to QRZ.com and you'll see my email address. Mel, and here we go. Eric, K2EJ, you got it.
All right, Dick. K2RIW, K2EJ. There's a couple of things that you failed to mention in your argument, and it tends to place you as how you look at the world. We have an atmosphere that's basically 5 miles thick, and it has a finite amount of volume, and it is a living system like most things on this earth. As you said, every day we're using maybe 1,000 years of organic growth. And by the way, most of the things that we get energy from starts out as some form of organic being. And the Earth goes through its cycles of putting carbon in the air. And that's why the Earth has had many different ice ages and major physiological changes throughout the millions of years of its existence. But if we're pulling out 1,000 years of biological growth every day, and we're turning it into not a complete conversion into energy. It's actually quite a messy conversion into energy. And that's why I bought the particular vehicle that I drive, which, by the way, does have dynamic braking and regeneration. but it's not a conventional Otto cycle engine. It's an Atkinson cycle engine, which actually provides for more complete combustion and puts much less carbon in the air and much less nitrogen in the air. Let it drop. So, is gasoline or petroleum products, burning them, a good thing to have? You also speak of, you know, people changing as society changes. And that in itself can actually say to people, well, if you're going to run on a hydrogen-based society, and you're only going to get 100 miles. By the way, there's a guy by the name of Dr. Osinski, who, he's actually the inventor of the nickel metal hydride battery, the components of it. And he has a hydrogen bottle that actually puts the hydrogen in the form of a solid state, but we can get into that later. So, as with everything else, as you've mentioned, in terms of what used to cost $20,000, now costs $200, same thing happens in other technologies besides electronics. There's lots of different ways of dealing with, let's just say, hydrogen for them. Let me drop. If we use a beautiful place like Iceland, where they actually have a lot of geothermal energy, which, by the way, they manufacture their electricity geothermally, and there's many different forms of geothermal energy. For example, I mean, you can reduce your air conditioning cost just by burying a big coil into a pipe in the ground and letting the earth absorb the heat in the summer, or letting the earth give you heat in the winter by using a heat pump. You're still using electricity. But Iceland is the example where people started with the fuel cell cars, you know, PEM-membrane cars, simply because electricity is almost free there. And they put together a couple of demonstration stations, which are electrolysis stations, and they're actually using them in Iceland. And there are also two hydrogen filling stations in Los Angeles, and it's growing. But now, if you want to start measuring BTUs of energy and make the conversions into watts and create everything in watts, where is your efficiency? Whereas that some people have calculated, if you were to, say, make a plug-in hybrid, where you actually charge the battery and store that energy, how much carbon fuel did you burn to store that energy as opposed to keeping that carbon fuel in the gas tank? I got one more thing to say, then I'm going to drop. In Europe, they paid, up until recently, $6 or $7, not a gallon, a liter. Okay? And of that $6 or $7 a liter, most of it went to provide for health care and all the things that the Europeans have that we don't, that they really are talking about. But the other thing that the Europeans do is they don't sell vehicles there that get 20 miles to the gallon. They don't even sell trucks that get 20 miles to the gallon anymore. They have really gone in terms of making their vehicles very efficient. But you also have to understand that they tend to have smaller cars because they have smaller roads. But, you know, that it's not unusual for my friend in France to try and make a decision whether he's going to buy a car that gets 55 miles to the gallon or 45 miles per gallon, you know, depending upon the luxury that he wants to have. But ultimately, should we be petroleum-based? Because there are a lot of technologies, like zinc air batteries, which has a higher density, but it's got its level of problems. But if society has to change, and it does take time for things to come in, where do you go? How do you think about that, Dick?
Yeah, I see some of the things that you're saying here, Eric. By the way, lots of people are slowly believing that global warming is a serious problem. That is not so clear. Recently was brought to my attention, I can't find it on my email right now, a very authoritative article written by somebody who's in the know, showing that past cycles of so-called global warming on the Earth have been much more severe than the one that we're going through right now, and that was before mankind had any intervention on it at all. So is mankind really causing the current what we believe is global warming, even though you've got some very enthusiastic people like Al Gore, among others, saying so emphatically, doesn't necessarily make it true. So if the United States elected a policy which is trying to drastically control the amount of carbon loading, carbon loading, I'm going to call it, so-called global warming report card points, and try to control that, and if in the process we are moving in the direction that's not making us energy independent or not helping our economy, it might not be the right way to go. Not so clear, even though people think it is. When it comes to hydrogen, methods of getting the hydrogen to run a vehicle, whether or not we should be using corn-based products to make alcohol-like substances, which, by the way, any of the alcohol-based fuels give you a smaller number of miles per gallon. Right now, if you take a look at the gas pump of the gas that you're now buying, you'll see what percentage of alcohol is in the gas you're now buying, which is lowering your gas mileage. Are we coming out ahead with that? It's not so clear. I do remember back in the days when I used to be traveling to Utica, New York every weekend because I was working at the Rome Air Development Center for about a two-year period of time. When I would fill up my gas tank in Herkimer, New York, because of the particular fuel mixture they were giving in Herkimer, I could drive my vehicle for the next week and a half. When I filled up my vehicle on Long Island and drove to Herkimer, I would have to refill the tank before I got there. I'm putting the same number of gallons in the same vehicle. And Herkimer isn't that many feet above sea level compared to Long Island. The altitude difference doesn't explain it. It was the differences in fuel. But we're all neglecting the fact that alcohol is a much lower energy density fuel than petroleum products. So it looks great that we're putting alcohol in our fuel, and therefore we need less oil. But because we get less mileage from it, are we really coming out ahead? Time somebody do that particular calculation. Anybody got questions or comments about all of this?
Give me repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
As I was starting to say, give me your call letters right now. KTRIW on the deck there.
This is KC2ONO.
KC2O, yeah.
Okay. ONO and OES in that order. Mr. ONO, start off with your name and your comment, sir.
KC2ONO, my name is Michael. This is the first time I'm listening in, and I have to say I'm absolutely amazed by the encyclopedic knowledge that's being exchanged. I have really nothing to add, but I'm really in awe in this discussion. Thanks very much for contributing.
Okay, I'm not sure if you said Mike or Mark, but made you appreciate it. We've got lots of opinions. We don't have very many solutions yet, Mark, but we're working on that. Mr. OES, KC2OES, I should know your name, a lot of your name, and your comments, sir.
Hi, Dick and all. This is Fred. First, I have an update, which is in reference to my rotor control problem with the same frequency for both remotes. I wound up finding accidentally a remote that I have in the house. The other thing is, I remember hearing about a fuel, hydrogen type, which is peroxide and aluminum particles or powder of some kind. Does anybody know anything about that?
No, it's a hydrogen generator.
Hey, give us a couple of words on that one, Eric.
Yeah, there's been a number of various different devices that generate hydrogen. You know, even if you go back into the time of World War II, when there was no gasoline domestically, what they would do is make the fuel regenerators, where you actually would hook a little trailer in the back of your car, you have a little fire going, you eat wood, and you turn that into a gas that burns. But the concept of the aluminum, you can take powdered aluminum, and there's various methods using water and acid and some of the basic chemical reactions that will liberate hydrogen from various different acids or alkalis. And it's a very old process, and it's, at today's prices, it's kind of like really expensive.
Fred, is that what you were looking for?
Yeah, I couldn't recall all the details. I think it had some kind of tie also to the, I believe it was the Kursk, the submarine that sank, the Russian submarine.
it was caused by some type of fuel in a torpedo that used hydrogen peroxide as a fuel.
Yeah, there are all kinds of exotic fuels that have been used in torpedoes, and all kinds of exotic batteries. And some of them, when they go into a failure mode, give off gases that are toxic to the people on the submarine. So you get some very serious problems. A submarine and an aircraft carrier deck are both very dangerous places to be. Lots of people die in both of those places. Well, a carrier deck is where much more people die than submarines, although we've had a couple of dramatic submarine failures over the last 40 or so years, some of them nuclear submarines that have gone down forever. So dangerous procedure, dangerous occupation. Global warming. I'm pretty sure right now if I did a survey of the people in the sound of our voices tonight, I'll bet you 90% of the population thinks that global warming is a serious problem. It may or may not be, and is mankind contributing to it? It may be yes and it may be no. Not a clear situation. When it comes to trying to evaluate the heat input and the heat output of the whole darn Earth simultaneously, boy, that's a difficult problem. We got some fancy satellites that do a lot of fancy monitoring, and yes, you see what appears to be lots of ice melting in Arctica and Antarctica. So there is some evidence that global warming has taken place, is taking place. Is mankind causing it is an interesting question. And what's the real outcome going to be? Is it so serious? Is it going to happen so fast that certain populations are going to have to abandon their current location and go to some other place? Is the weather pattern going to be affected? Will El Nino get worse or better? Or will the monsoons in Asia get worse? Will the droughts in portions of Africa get worse? Interesting questions to speculate about. As I see it, energy is something that every human being needs a certain amount of. In the case of people in the United States, the average person runs something like 1,000 watts per day continuously is the energy input required to maintain your lifestyle. There are a lot of people in second and third world countries that are now coming up to speed where they too are going to be tapping into the same resources of coal, oil, and energy. And therefore, the demand is going to increase, the supply is not going to be able to increase fast enough, and therefore more expensive oil is going to take place. We're now very unhappy about the fact that oil in a drop something like $130 a barrel on a really bad day on the stock market. Will the day come when it's going to be $200 a barrel? The answer is yes. Will that day be in a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year? Some rather small amount of time, because the total energy requirement of the human beings on this planet is increasing at a rather predictable rate. Tremendous amounts of resources are being manufactured in places like Shenzhen, China. China, the majority of the people in China don't have anywhere near the energy consumption of an American. However, they are slowly adapting our lifestyle. They're going to want our benefits. It's going to take energy to do it. They're going to be demanding the same resources that we're demanding. So a bottleneck is coming. We really have to be energy independent. That's the way I see it. I may be wrong, I may be naive, but we've got to work on energy independence. That and the economy are two very important factors. Another important factor is healthcare. I heard a report on NPR recently that is kind of startling to me. Let me drop. Some significant percentage of Americans have absolutely no health care. In countries that have more socialized medicine, like Canada, in theory, every single citizen in Canada is virtually guaranteed health care, essentially free of charge. The Canadian citizens are paying 13% of their salary to maintain that health care system. The average American is paying 16% of our income to maintain our health care system, and a high percentage of our population has no health care. Something's not right. There's got to be a corrective action. To have people have to go to an emergency room because there's no other choice because they need medical care, doesn't seem right. And because of some of the medical care they're not getting that has long-range effects, the total cost that happens increases as opposed to decreasing. So I hope that our candidates for president will recognize some of these major items. That's an opinion. K2RIW listening.
Okay, very good.
Eric recognized. Anyone else? Go ahead, Eric. Eric, if you were president, how would you solve all this?
All right, I want to have a go at a couple of things. NASA has been keeping records for many years and pictures of the Earth as to what has transpired. Okay, we do know that it has been calculated that the volume of ice that is in the Antarctic and in the Arctic equals so many cubic feet of water. Okay. Now, if I remember correctly, now, of course, we're talking salt water here, so I don't know exactly what the temperature is, but let's assume it was fresh water. So, as long as we are at 31 degrees in average year-round temperature, okay, now ice is going to stay ice. All right, well, let's say we have a really sunny year, and the average yearly temperature becomes, say, 33 degrees. And ice is going to melt, and what's going to happen is sea level is going to rise, okay? Blame it on the cycle of the Earth, blame it on solar warming, blame it on, you know, human consumption and dumping in the atmosphere, helping to raise the average year-round temperature. And if you see that kind of thing happening, you know the ice is receding. What if it doesn't evaporate? Go nowhere. So sea level rises. There's a lot of things that are going on in terms of, like, the biology of the oceans are becoming sick, so to speak, where there are places where the ocean is fully saturated with carbon dioxide, it's not releasing. So the fish don't have a happy time getting the oxygen out of the water. There are many little indicators like that, if we actually were to look at them. Because all it takes is that 1 degree change to have some catastrophe happen. All right? The concept of weather and the increase of the amount of energy, I mean, I dropped, the increase in intensity of, say, hurricanes. Well, nobody bothers to ask, what's the basic, why does nature have hurricanes? Well, hurricanes are the way the Earth gets rid of excess heat. There's been a lot of studies done and a lot of new understandings that have actually been put into the supercomputers that they use to predict weather and hurricanes. All this new data that they found actually works out well in seeing how these things move. But what they do is they help the Earth vent excess heat. We'll look at it from a simplistic point of view. The atmosphere gets warmer, there's more energy. They turn with more intensity, they throw more heat off. So, all of these things, you want to call it global warming? If you look back in a time in history where there wasn't the industrialized world, where they didn't throw stuff into the atmosphere, the Earth did these kind of things when lightning would strike a forest and it would put all this carbon dioxide in the air. Or a volcano would erupt and cover half the surface of the Earth. Makes major changes. Let me let it drop one more time. There is, I don't remember the name of the canyon. There was an overdone on it. And it was a question of whether this particular part of the Grand Canyon took hundreds of years or whether it was a catastrophic event. It's somewhere up north, and I can't think of the name of it now, but the conclusion after doing all the geological investigations, this was essentially a lake that was held with a frozen wall, and then when the temperature immediately changed, out comes this release, like a big dam breaking, release of billions and billions of gallons of water, and it etched this ravine, this gorge that became this particular canyon. And if I could remember the name of it, I would tell you, but I will have to go look at That's my collection of Novas to find out which one it is, and I'll tell you that. But that you could actually change the, in as little as one day. K2RIWK,
E2Z. I'm going to agree with you in three quarters of what you said, Eric. The current NASA photographs taken over the last approximately 20 years shows a significant amount of ice melting in the Antarctic, for instance. So a degree of global warming has taken place. That's essentially a given. However, what in your opinion, Eric, is the probability that the majority of it was caused by mankind? I'm asking for an opinion on that one, Eric. Go ahead.
All right. I'll tell you. You consider the amount of carbon dioxide that's pumped into the air every day, the amount of nitrous oxide that's pumped into the air every day. Something's got to happen to it. Okay. Never before in human history have we done such a thing. Okay. We've done it in the past, but not in the quantity and the incredible amount that we do now. Plus, you mentioned China. You've got to mention India. India is another place with a billion people. And they're all becoming very middle class. China, too. There's less and less areas of rice paddy area, and there's more and more industrialization. And as you will see in this Beijing Olympics, the amount of pollution that is created just around Beijing from not only cars, but the incredible amount of cars. That's one of the reasons why the gas price is so high, is that, you know, we're in competition for who's getting the oil. Yes, we're buying a lot of foreign oil. Oh, and by the way, the Saudis were asked to pump more, and they said no. And the reason for that really is that, as we know, each reserve that is found, each big golden pot of oil, has a limited quantity. And it has been said over the past 2 years that that part of the Middle East, they've pumped the best of what they're pumping. They're now on the downside. So, there you go. Yeah, I think man has a lot to do with it. I'm not saying that man is a total complete cause, because that's not the case. Mother Earth helps with her along as well, too, you know. K2RIWK.
Yeah, I've seen one report where just the methane gas given off by the digestive systems of bovines, that doesn't only mean cows, it means other kinds of cattle, reindeer, and whatever, may be a bigger contributor than all of mankind's actions. I'm not sure about that. Mankind is making a contribution, but is it the major contribution? And if we did all of the corrective action that we're able to do within the constraints of what we're willing to sacrifice in our lifestyle and our economy, I would be amazed if mankind put forth a serious effort, if they can change by more than 1 or 2% the amount of carbon loading of the atmosphere that mankind is creating. And if what mankind is doing is only 1% of what the Earth is doing, can we really correct the global warming that appears to be taking place? There are a number of smart people who think the answer is no. Should we give up and say, I don't care? Of course not. We've got to keep hacking away at the problem of understanding it, understand the causative agent, understand the possible corrective action, and realistically apply corrective action. I, for one, think that if it's done with intelligence, we could be drilling in Anwar, we could be drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, we could be setting up more refineries, we could be setting up wind farms that are 4 miles offshore that you just barely see with the naked eye. It takes a set of binoculars to receive them. To not do that, it's crazy. There are countries and areas of the United States where wind farms are extremely successful. Solar farms are extremely successful. To say, not in my backyard, it's much too simplistic. Very similar to what's going on in certain communities in Long Island, which are attempting to remove all radio antennas from their community. Very foolish. They think they're protecting their children. Well, in the case of Bayville, for instance, the police force only has a certain percentage of coverage radio-wise in that town with the current antennas. and they want those antennas eliminated, which means the police force will have less coverage. And without the police force and your emergency services having good radio coverage, more people will be injured, and some of them will die. It's a expensive decision as far as life and limit is concerned, in my opinion. These people mean well. I've tried to give testimony before their town board on one occasion. These people are sincere. They're misinformed. What has happened is they have thoroughly misunderstood a particular vocabulary. The vocabulary they're understanding is that darn word RF radiation, radio frequency radiation. In the days of 1920, when you realize that a radio wave spreads out in all directions, which means it radiates, therefore you can call the effect radiation, perfectly good word. Along come World War II and nuclear radiation, and all of a sudden the word radiation means nuclear and it means cancer. Had we been smart enough to call it RF signaling, RF transmission, wireless signaling, and we had used any other combination of words without the word radiation, we wouldn't have this problem. It's a vocabulary problem. We're afraid of that word. It's an irrational fear. And boy, is there a lot of human suffering taking place because of that irrational fear of that word. RF energy, when it strikes your body, at VHF frequencies, the most absorptive frequency region is 30 to 300. All of the RF energy that strikes your body does absolutely nothing else but get turned into heat. The RF energy that gets absorbed gets turned into heat. It does nothing else. So if you're afraid of a 100-watt radio transmitter, which is a big one, being in the same room with you, you should also be afraid of a 100-watt old-fashioned light bulb in the same room with you. Both of them are creating the same amount of heating of your body. Are you going to avoid light bulbs? Are you going to avoid going out in the sun on a sunny day? Because the thermal radiation is giving you 1,000 watts per square meter of your body. 1,000 watts of solar energy hits your body when you lay down in the sun on a sunny day on the beach. Is that something that we should fear? The 10-watt type transmitters that are in that town, that are 200 feet away from the nearest human being, it's the equivalent of a 10-watt light bulb being 200 feet away. The same amount of heating takes place. It's an irrational fear. I tried making that clear. I did not succeed. I'm open to suggestions. K2RIW on the tech net.
Hey, Dick.
Yes, sir. Who are you?
Hi there. And to us, Alaskan. I just sent you those emails. That last one was on global warming. I think that's the one you were reading. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Who was that? Was that Eric?
Yeah, I got more.
Go ahead, Eric.
All right, going back to the oil business and possibly warming the earth, you got to look at the total picture because petroleum is one of the things that we use to put into the atmosphere. Mother Nature has the thing that she uses to clean the atmosphere, but human beings have this really awful problem of eliminating those things. They're called trees. And the earth has lost one heck of a lot of trees and vegetation. So all that really wonderful carbon dioxide the trees love and turn back into oxygen, those conversions have disappeared from the planet. And that's been a very significant change according to a lot of climatologists. So, you know, it's something not to be ignored because the earth is a living system and it has so many different components and they all at one time or another work in perfect harmony with each other. But if we keep messing that the harmony up, something's got to give. As far as, you know, the not in my backyard scene, there are places in the country where they don't really allow that to happen. They welcome it. There are places in Pennsylvania. Hawaii is a big place. There's huge wind farms all over the place. One of the drawbacks of solar and huge wind farms, one of the big drawbacks of, say, in the Mojave Desert, it's a beautiful place to put the solar energy farms, and California Edison's been doing that.
even if you turn it into 1,000,000 volts, when you stuff it down a wire, and you're going to take it 400 miles, 500 miles, 1,000 miles, guess what? You lose energy, you know? So there's the problem with distribution. That's where the liquid energy has its disadvantages. But we could also come up with ways of creating combustion that produces the perfect output, which would be water. Because if you think about it, when you burn something, what's burning? It's the hydrogen component. If you have a simple alcohol, you have maybe four atoms of hydrogen attached to oxygen and carbon. And if you're looking at gasoline or some complex oil, you may be having, you know, 14 or even from what I remember is a molecule has 24 atoms of hydrogen. And it always burns with oxygen. So if you can eliminate the waste of all the other atoms in that material, the end result would be water, which is not a bad pollutant. But there are technologies to do that, but it takes a tremendous amount of energy. That's the problem. And one more thing. In this last series of government in our country, different than other places, but in our country, in the good old U.S. of A., there was a law written in Congress that was enacted that basically says nothing is real unless you can prove it to be absolutely so. And what that means is that, say for example, you know that if you give 100 people a gram of arsenic, that maybe 98 people are going to die. So the way the law sees it is that it's safe. You know, you can't guarantee that it's going to kill the people 100% of the time. And that's the paradigm that wonderful Congress has been using in terms of even measuring or allowing that there's a possibility of something that could have a negative effect. Rather than to create a situation where you avoid the negative effect and you don't have to deal with it, we allow it. And that is a big problem.
Yeah, those wind farms that they have in the Mojave Desert in central or northern California, I've been there. It's called the Tehachapi Mountain Wind Farm. Very successful project by my standards. So wind, and here on Long Island, particularly off the South Shore, we've got a lot of wind. We could be getting a lot of energy out of it. I'll admit that the payback time is not super desirable, but it looks to me like the project is being abandoned because a small percentage of the population is complaining about it. And I don't think it's a valid complaint. They're complaining about change. Change is going to happen. If people were not allowing the change to happen, if you didn't have a guy like Robert Moses, we wouldn't have the northern states, the southern states, the Robert Moses Parkway, the Causeway over to Fire Island. You wouldn't have Jones Beach. And had he lived long enough, we would have had a bridge across the Long Island Sound into Connecticut. And boy, do we need that. He died too soon. He's a guy that used strong-arm tactics, but boy, he was right when it comes to making the most benefit for the most number of people, even though a small number of individuals thought they were being mistreated by him, and that they were saying, not in my backyard. He had the political clout to do it. We need another Robert Moses. When it comes to forest. I think you've hit on a very big one there, Mark. I mean, Eric. Yes, South America, tremendous numbers of square miles of forest, deforestation, are taking place. And this has a real big impact. I'm going to ask you for a guess on this one. Which do you think has more of an effect on the carbon loading of the atmosphere and global warming? The deforestation that is taking place, is that more or less than what we could controllably change with what we're doing with the hydrocarbon burning? Back to you on that one, Eric.
All right. KRWK, JJ. I'm not going to say, because I actually have those statistics somewhere, and I need to pick them up. I'm in the car. So I know what my feeling is, and I think I know what I remember, but
As you know, the way memory works and the way the hippocampus does all that connecting of the dots, I'm not absolutely sure, so I'm not going to say at this point. But it's significant. It is major significant. And by the way, South America is not the only place where there's deforestation. There's deforestation of rainforest, which is the highest density. There's been the complete, you know, stripping of many areas of our country where our various lumber companies, before they learned that they needed to make it a renewable resource instead of a one-way resource because they found themselves not having trees to cut down. But in the developing areas where there are billions of people like China, they have done very major clear cutting, and they're making some of the very big mistakes that we've made in the past in the Northwest and in Canada. India doesn't have the same kind of density, but where they do have their vegetation, or where they did have their vegetation, they don't no more because they got people all over it. So there, K2RW gave you things.
Okay, let's assume now that a real good study was done, Eric, and that deforestation is a major cause of global warming. And there may be a fair amount of evidence of that. And now, in our intelligence, we're going to control deforestation. The people doing the deforestation, I think, have two major motivations. One, it is a lumber company selling the wood. Or number two, it is a group of people who want to clear the land because they want to live on the land, they want to farm on the land, or whatever. So they're clearing the land either for human usage or for selling of the wood. Assuming that those two factors are true, that the deforestation is a major cause of our problem, and we now know why deforestation is taking place, what controls do we have to try to slow down deforestation? There's going to be lumber companies that are going to be selling the wood. To stop them from doing their business is not going to be easy. There are human beings that want to occupy that rainforest land, and they want the trees cleared. How do we stop urban sprawl or population expansion into those areas? How would we control deforestation if we think it was a major cause? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, there actually are quite a number of groups. By the way, most of, in South America, most of the deforestation is not for wood, it's for creating farmland, where it's not only income for those individuals that are doing the farming, but because of the population increases, most people aren't really aware that there's a worldwide food shortage. And as the climate shift and change, where one used to be able to grow one crop no longer can. And that's happening, and that's, you know, the El Nino is having effects in certain parts of the tropical areas of the Earth where that's actually having what they're calling a measurable effect. But, you know, deforestation really is an indication of the human, you know, spreading out, increasing its number. It's sort of like a disease taking over the Earth, kind of, until at some point it no longer supports things because, I mean, one of the most basic functions that nature created is that plants use the opposite of what we use. Just actually in terms of when they finally get down to their reaction, the conversion of sunlight into ATP and then eventually sugar and oxygen, because anything that burns, human, biological, plant, is all based on oxygen burning. So if you remove that element that does the cleaning, or the house cleaning, the earth doesn't do it so efficiently anymore. It means you have an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which we do know as the concentration of CO2 increases, the amount of greenhouse effect increases. And that becomes part of the cycle. The Earth will try its best to fix itself in many different ways, with weather, hurricanes,
so on and so forth. But if we do it at a rate faster than Mother Earth can take care of itself, she's going to be in big trouble.
Let me hit you with a concept. If the deforestation in South America, India, and China is taking place because of farming, I think that's good. The trees that were there were taking the oxygen, the atmosphere, the sunlight, the water, the minerals, and creating carbohydrates. That is the food for the plant, and giving off oxygen. That's good for us. The total amount of carbohydrate created by a forest, an acre of forest, and if I now create that into an acre of farmland, and the farmland is using the same sun on a different kind of plant, creating carbohydrates, which are the food for human beings, is it possible that good, efficient farming does almost the same amount of carbohydrate generation as the forest did? In which case, the farming might almost be a balance for what the rainforest used to do. Am I naive on that one, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. As a matter of fact, I was reading, this was about 4 or 5 months ago, I was reading a study where they actually looked at productive square, number of acres of what was actual forest, number of acres of a well-organized farming community. I think they were using like sugar. With sugar and corn, I think they were using as measurements. But because of forestation density, and because it's merely a square area of light-gathering devices, which in terms of a forest, the trees, we're talking leaves, and another plant, we are talking leaves, but they're usually the lesser part. And the studies have shown that really good, efficient, modern farming can almost come close, but never quite measures up.
K2KY with a comment?
No recognized. I accept that. So, I think you're saying farming comes close, but the amount of coverage of the sunlight by the leaves in farming may not be quite as high. I can remember a couple of times when I was walking through a bean field in Maryland where I couldn't see any soil. I saw nothing but all the leaves of those bean plants. I think it was a bean field. So I saw a very dense field. I was there because of the youth. as a misguided youth, I was with a friend firing a 22 rifle at a vulture, who decided to get away from me by diving into the bean field, and he walking around the bean field, I never saw him again. Such beautiful coverage. Go ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW. How would you solve all this, Mel?
Okay, now I'm just going to make a comment about the rainforest down in South America. This slash and burn bit that's been really destroying great mounds of the rainforest. They showed that why they keep slashing and burning, basically, the people, they come onto this land, and after they strip it, they are planting, their crops.
The atmosphere, whenever a normal human being draws a picture of the Earth and draws a picture of the atmosphere around it, they draw the atmosphere about one quarter the radius of the Earth. Think about it. The atmosphere is roughly 6 miles thick, and the Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter. When you look at that globe that sits of the Earth that sits on your table, the thickness of the paint on that globe is close to the thickness of the atmosphere on this planet. Compared to the diameter of the Earth, the atmosphere is very, very thin. And yet, my goodness, is that important to us. Mars, for instance, has 0.7% of our atmospheric pressure. It's a very sparse atmosphere, very cold environment, and it's a desert, and I'm pretty sure you don't want to send a human being there. You want to send all kinds of remote space probes like Spirit and Opportunity and the new one that just landed. I can't think of the name of it right now. It'll come to me in a minute. If Paul is there, he's going to tell us the name of it. Okay.
You talking about the Phoenix mission?
I sure am. Thank you. Phoenix mission. So you got these beautiful remotely controlled machines roaming around Mars, taking pictures from orbit of Mars, and that's the right way to study the planet. You don't want to send a human being there. The resources required to get a human being there are just out of sight, in both dollars and pounds and years and life at risk and whatever. Not the place to send a human being. You only want to send a human being to the places that have got some kind of a breathable atmosphere, in my opinion. Because if, when a guy's going to be on the surface there for a year, and he has to be dependent on artificially created atmosphere for that whole year, and you can't interrupt that atmosphere by more than a few percent for more than a couple of minutes, and the human being dies. We're very dependent on that atmosphere. So we have to protect our atmosphere. And is global warming something that we got to worry about? We'll soon find out. Hey, Paul, I wonder if we should send over to you right now for the space report. What's going on in space, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, the last I heard about the Phoenix was that they were in the process of digging up dirt, and I haven't looked in on it in the last couple of days. They got as far as digging some of the dirt up, and they wanted to put it into the Tiga machine, machine that tests the soil. It keeps things up, and they can test the vapors that are coming off of it with a spectrometer. They wanted to do that, but it spilled onto the deck of the Phoenix spacecraft. It's going to go where they wanted it to go, and I know they were looking to correct that problem. This problem, of course, has to be corrected. You're operating an 8-foot-long arm, and this thing is 100 million miles away, 20-some-odd minutes radio time, so you can't operate a joystick here on Earth and operate this thing in real time. They sent commands to the spacecraft to correct these problems. So every little thing they do to operate this arm has to be done with another identical ship right there in the JPL. They'll run the program into the identical Phoenix lander and see how it does when they scoop something up and where it's going to go. And last I heard, they were going to do that, make sure that worked okay. And if that was okay, they were going to upload the software to the Phoenix sitting on the northern hemisphere of Mars to see if they can do the same. And the next step would be there's an auger in the back of the scoop. Let me drop it. To actually dig into ice that will be below the dirt, and they'll be able to accumulate some of that material from drilling actually through the back of the scoop, and it will arrive inside the scoop that way. A lot of people think the scoop is just like a backhoe. They're going to dig straight down, get rid of some of the dirt, and then keep digging into the ice and with the scoop and put it into the test tester that way. But that's not true. The scoop is really just to dig the dirt until they get to the ice. They'll never be able to use the scoop to dig into the ice. It would be like concrete at those temperatures. So they need to actually drill with like a masonry bit in the back of the scoop to particleize it, turn it almost into like a powder, just water ice, and get it into the scoop that way. And then from that point, bring this 8-foot long arm into the area where they can put it into the tester. So that's the last I heard. Maybe they've done that by now. I don't know. I'll have to check the internet. And the other news was Discovery, of course, got back safe yesterday. Yesterday landed at Kennedy in Florida. And the next big mission is a couple of months away. They pretty much got the International Space Station, all the major modules put on. There's a third part of this Kaibo module that was built by Japan two missions ago. They brought the first part up. this last mission, they brought the main part up, 14 foot diameter, 34 foot long cylinder, biggest compartment yet to be brought up. They brought that up on this mission, and then there's a third part of it that's pretty big, but it's an outside platform that's going to be mounted to it, and is already operating. They have robotic arms that are operating on this contraption. There's more arms on the space station than if you can believe. You've got two robotic arms on the Kaibo machine. Let me drop it. You've got the original Canada arm two on the space station. You've got this other robotic contraption that they put up there a couple of flights ago. 12-foot long thing with shoulders and arms. That has two arms attached to it. So the Russians also have an arm backed by them. So there's plenty of arms up there. So to make a long story short, Discovery got back and everything's fine. There was a little piece in the news about some little piece that was holding the thermal blanket in place was missing a little clip, but so that float away in space, but that was of no concern, really.